Hey gang, this week's episode is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the grand slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers, capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, Newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with a special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on Newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. And now, here's our show.
This is the story about the early days of baseball. It is the story of what it was like and how it felt to be a baseball player at the turn of the century and in the decades shortly thereafter. This is also the story of America at the turn of the century and prior to World War I, a time of cobblestone streets and horse-drawn trolleys. It is the story of young man's hopes, his struggles, his triumphs and his failures in what history has recorded as the quiet time. It is about the time when the fate of young men was seen as their own doing, and hard work was viewed as the pathway to success. It is about the time of carriages and hansom cabs, and the time when some men looked to the sky. It is about the time in baseball when Ty Cobb would win 12 batting championships in 13 years and had a .371 average in the 1 year he didn't win. It is about the time when home run champions could win the title with 6 or 10 or 19. It is about the time of John McGraw, Iron Man McGinty, and Christy Mathewson. The time of Walter Johnson, of Rube Marquard, Tommy Leach, and Honus Wagner. All these were honored in their generation and were the glory of their times.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
Well, greetings and salutations, my friends. It is indeed Tim Hanlon and is, of course, Good Seats Still Available, the curious little podcast that is devoted to what used to be in professional sports. We appreciate you finding us, and we are definitely going to be in used-to-be territory this week as we go back to baseball. And our brilliant guest, Kevin Baker, the author of the awesome new tome, and I do mean tome, but in a good way, about the history, the early history of baseball and New York. It's called The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. And it is a fascinating take on the history of baseball, but seen through the lens of a growing metropolis, that being the New York City, well, metropolitan area for that matter, in many respects, almost a cradle of the game. Certainly not the only place where the big time version of the game was played in the 1800s and early 1900s and beyond, but clearly influential, and that's probably understating the contributions of the five boroughs and the greater area that is metropolitan New York City. And the sport that, frankly, in those decades, those many decades, has become, was synonymous with the history of the region itself. And Kevin's take is fascinating. And it does, we take a spotlight to the earliest days of baseball. And as you'll hear in this conversation, that kind of really goes from, you know, the earliest signals of a professional game in the 1800s to about almost pre-war, maybe mid-war, 1940s or so. You'll hear that this is but the only the first half of the entire story of New York and baseball. And the clip, I think, sets it up in, I think, a dramatic fashion, right? The movie that you may remember from back in the day, it actually came out in 1977. It was made in 1971, and it was based on a book written by a guy named Lawrence Ritter, a very seminal book called The Glory of Their Times, of course, the story of the early days of baseball, told by the men who played it. Now, anybody who's read that book will know that that is an absolute essential book to have on one's history shelf, because it literally, in first-person terms, talks about a lot of the era that we're going to be discussing today with Kevin. The difference of our story today is that this is largely through the lens of New York City, but half of the names that you heard there in that clip by the great dulcet tone narration of Alexander Scourby, a name that probably eludes you, but the voice is certainly unmistakable. In this Bud Greenspan made television movie out of the book, it really gives you a sense of how commingled the city and suburbs of New York City and that of baseball came together. And I couldn't think of a better book to kind of sort of set sort of the ground rules, if you will, for this conversation, because to know some of these players and in their first person voices, this book is almost a warm embrace of that look through the lens of Gotham. And I think you will enjoy not only this conversation, but I know you will enjoy this book. And again, it is called The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. And it is by Kevin Baker. It is literally just out as we drop this episode. I think it's been out for nary a week. It is published by Knopf. Sorry. I never can pronounce that correctly because I always get screwed up on it. It's Knopf, K-N-O-P-F, a long time and major imprint in the publishing world. So shame on me for not recognizing and remembering it the first time out. You can find it wherever good books are found. If you'd like to go down the street to your local independent bookseller and have them order up a copy for you, by all means do that. Or you can go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Search up this episode number 340, and you will find a convenient link or two to this book. And give a listen to this conversation first, of course. And run, don't walk, to get yourself a copy of this. You know, if you grew up in the New York area, you're going to love this. If you didn't grow up in the New York area and you're a baseball fan, you're going to love this, because on both counts, this is going to, you're going to learn a little something, right? You're going to learn about baseball if you're a New Yorker and you had a passing understanding of some of the teams. And I'm not talking about just the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants. I'm talking about teams that preceded even them and some of the versions of stadiums that preceded them, the older versions of Yankee Stadium, the older versions, plural, of the Polo Grounds. And I'm talking about teams like the New York Mutuals and the Brooklyn Atlantics, Excelsior of Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Tip Tops, lots of Brooklyn teams in there. Clearly the New York Giants in their various earlier forms, but also teams like the Newark Bears, right, in New Jersey, Negro League teams like the Brooklyn Royal Giants, or the Lincoln Giants, or the New York Black Yankees, New York Cubans, and the Newark Eagles, etc. All of those teams are very much the threads of this conversation coming up right now with our new pal, Kevin Baker. Let's talk about the New York game. It's not only baseball in New York, but certainly it's a conversation that gives New York a lot of props in the evolution of the history of the professional game. Here's the conversation we had a couple of weeks back. Please, as always, enjoy. I have some assumptions as to sort of why this book is in its promotional status now, why you wrote it. But
right,
give me a sense of, and our audience a sense of, why New York and baseball for you? Because I think there's some professional giveaways, if you will, mm-hmm. from some of your previous
yes.
work. That
might, yeah. yeah. You mean, for instance, like the first novel I wrote, which was Sometimes You See It Coming, and also did an As Told To with Reggie Jackson, becoming Mr. October. Talking about his first couple of years in New York. Yeah, I've been a New York City baseball fan since 1966. I've always, long been fascinated by the game. And in doing all sorts of reading into it and looking back on the game over the years, really ca came to realize that the modern game of baseball, as we know it, was really started in New York. People have played bat and ball games since we got off the savannah, all sorts of different games. There were Polish laborers at Jamestown Colony who played something called long ball. Bat and ball games go way back. But what we think of as modern baseball really came out of the Knickerbocker rules, which started in New York City.
Well, sure, and a thing or two or seven about sort of the early days of New York
Yeah.
City. Maybe a little bit of background of sort of
Sure.
that entree into not only your professional career, because you're not born and raised in New York. I know you went to college at Columbia, but
Yeah.
I'm curious as to where and why and how that sort of interest
Right.
slash expertise, if you will, over the years has sort of came about.
Sure. I mean, both of my parents were born in the city. My father was born in Fordham Road, and my mother was born up in Washington Heights. I was born in New Jersey, and grew up partly in Massachusetts, a place I absolutely love, except it was hard being a New York sports fan up there. And came back here for college and have really made, a great deal, as you say, a great deal of my career, writing about New York history, including historical novels. I've written four large historical novels about the city, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, Stryver's Row, and The Big Crowd. I've written a lot of nonfiction about the city too. It really has become, sort of a fascination over the years.
So as this topic sort of swirled in your head, I'm curious as to
Yeah.
why you didn't go the fictional route versus the non-fictional route, which you chose for this book.
Yeah, well, I've already, written a baseball novel, and this was it really was the brainstorm of my editor at Knopf, Andrew Miller, who I've known for many years, and he came up with this back around the turn of this century when New York City baseball was at one of its heights, one of its golden ages. The great moments, 1998 into the early 2000s, where it seemed every year one or both New York teams had a real shot and were playing in the playoffs, incredibly exciting games. And the first subway series in the city since 1956 and 2000. So this was, a very exciting era. The whole town really seemed enthused about baseball. You had that memorable meeting in Bryant Park, big kind of rally, like a citywide rally in the heart of downtown Manhattan, right off Times Square, where right before the 2000 World Series, where everyone was out just really enjoying it. It was sort of this great moment in New York. I think the rest of the country hated it. The 2000 World Series had terrible ratings, but were for a few years the worst ratings of any World Series. But for New Yorkers, this was great fun. So the book, to a certain degree, came out of this great moment.
Well, I love it especially because I too grew up in my case Northern New Jersey
Right.
and inherited a New York Yankees a fork of baseball fandom, whether I liked it or not. My paternal grandfather was in the printing business and worked with Topps baseball cards, and the New York Yankees was one of his big accounts. And my maternal grandfather was in the wholesale liquor distribution business, and one of his big clients was Ballantine Ale, another indistinguishable connection to
Yeah.
Yankees franchise. So,
Where in, if I may ask, where in northern New Jersey were you born?
Little town called Hohokus.
Okay.
I've near Ridgewood, Saddle River. I was born in Passaic. So we kind of gravitated to a little higher order existence. But I will say, look, any child of that era and from that region, right, just by birthright, probably not unlike Boston and some other areas, or Chicago, right? You sort of kind of grow up and you have that sort of bias sort of built in. But but it's only as you get older do you recognize just how deeply those roots go. And in this particular case, right? I mean, there's even a more fascinating sort of era, even before the Dodgers and the Yankees. I mean, that you know, vividly sort of portray in this stuff. I mean, you mentioned the Knickerbocker style of baseball. The Knickerbockers were one of the first baseball teams ever, like in the in professional baseball, right? So,
Very much so. And you know, that for years is one of the myths about the start of American baseball. And there are many terrific myths about it, one of which led to the Hall of Fame being in Cooperstown, as opposed to maybe New York, where it probably deserves to be. But the Knickerbockers were an early team. And in the first kind of, you know, kids' history of baseball that I read, which I still have with the cover falling off it, it's a terrific book, but they talked about how the first real baseball game was over in Hoboken on June 19th, 1846, between the Knickerbockers and the kind of mysterious New York Baseball Club. And the Knickerbockers lost 23-1. And even as an 8-year-old, that story seemed kind of suspicious. You know, how was it that the Knickerbockers were the first team, but they, you know, they got their butts handed to them by this other team that was practically anonymous. And so looking into it over the years, you realize, of course, that that wasn't how it started. But the Knickerbockers were the team, were the club of guys, clerks, doctors, others playing ball who first kind of consolidated the rules, and that, you know, and that became, those rules became modern baseball.
Well, it also was a wellspring. I mean, you also get into not only sort of the clubs, like Brooklyn in particular, and the upper regions of Manhattan and the various, but also the various playing fields too. And, you know, there's no better sort of, I guess, microcosm of all of that is the polo grounds, right? And it kind of revolves around, okay, which one are you talking about, right? Because it's not all the same. Right. Yet literally those eras of the polo grounds are almost as synonymous with sort of the rise and the change and the evolution of the game writ large, as well as in New York.
Sure. Finding a place to play was a constant problem for professional baseball in New York. And it was something that became very tied up with the city's famously corrupt political structure, particularly with Tammany Hall. The polo grounds are a great example. It used to be said for many years that the polo grounds that everybody knew in New York, the polo grounds up in Harlem by 157th Street, no one had ever played polo there. Excuse me. And that was true. It was because the original polo grounds were just off sort of the northeastern edge of Central Park, and they were where a very flamboyant, very drunken publisher of the New York Herald, James Gordon Bennett Jr., you know, actually kept his polo ponies and played polo. Bennett kind of drank his way out of New York society. He went to an engagement party with, you know, at his fiance's house, and came in so drunk that he urinated in the fireplace. So, and that was kind of unforgivable. He spent most of the rest of his life in Europe, but he had the, you know, he wanted to get rid of this property, the polo grounds. And so they sold them off to the original New York baseball giants, as they used to be called. Then actually first to the New York Metropolitan, as you know, this is had these names go back and forth in New York. They were the New York Metropolitan, who became the Giants, and then they were replaced by the Mets. You know, but originally the New York Metropolitan played in this field up in, you know, up around 110th Street in Manhattan. And that was, you know, where they were for some years. Then they eventually moved up to land that had actually been underwater and was reclaimed from the East River, Harlem River, and made into the Polo Grounds ball field, which was one of the weirdest baseball parks ever in the major leagues, and wonderfully weird. It led to the shape of it alone led to two of the greatest moments in baseball history.
Oh, certainly, and it also too is fascinating that that the final version was literally, you know, right across the bridge there. I guess it was a bridge. Maybe there's a river. I can't remember what was
No,
the
it is a
demarcation of
bridge.
Yankee Stadium, the new game, or the current. Yeah, for the not the current, but but pretty darn close footprint version, two of Yankee Stadium, maybe even one.
Of the I guess the first real Yankee Stadium, in the Bronx, very much so. You could actually, in 1951, after Bobby Thompson's home run, one of the amazing moments that the ball in the old Polo Grounds, fans were lining up for World Series tickets, supposedly at the both ballparks, Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds, and shouting back and forth at each other, supposedly across the river. They were that close. It was just a wonderful bit. I mean, these were really inner city ballparks. The subway, still runs, the elevated part of the subway runs right past Yankee Stadium. It ran past the Polo Grounds too, that and Ebbets Field in Brooklyn. These were parks right in the middle of cities, right where people lived. And there was a great aspect to that.
Why do you think the New York region and the city in particular became the wellspring for the game and the professional version of the game in the late 1800s, eventually? I mean, I know there were obviously teams like Cincinnati or whatever that, you know, in the sort of as the leagues started to actually form and professionalism and all its debauchery started to come into play, but why New York? I mean, I think there's some pretty basic reasons, but this, you know, it could have happened elsewhere in this country too, up or down the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, New York is just so unique in this regard. I'm just curious as to where is there any insight that you gleaned in all of this?
Well, that's a good question. I think in part it was a city game, and that's one of the big points of this book, is that it real baseball really is a city game, because you need a city to get this many people together for a game, whether this many kids or this many guys, in the middle of the day. American farm life is on a scale where it's very hard to assemble 18 guys, or however many people you'd have playing a game. I think it's one of the reasons they called it town ball, because you'd play it when you were in town, or maybe on Sunday. But in New York, you could play it any day. You had this, people were easy to assemble. Why New York in particular is a, somewhat harder question. There was a Philadelphia game as well. There was a Massachusetts game. And these were all, these were fairly popular with adherents around those cities too. The New York games, though, sort of reflected the city in general, the pace of the city. Believe it or not, baseball was originally considered a very fast game. Walt Whitman refers to it as America's game because of the zip and snap and pop of it. And this really was what it was like. As late as 1918, there was a 58-minute game played in the National League between the Giants and the Phillies. This fit in great for New Yorkers. You could get that game done at lunch, go back to work. It was very much something that appealed, to the city's pace.
This is part of what I enjoyed about this book so far. The one chapter you talk about, we call it scholastic contests, which the fits and starts of getting yeah. from sort of a game into a professional endeavor, and not necessarily yeah. the noble pursuit, so to speak. But you talk about you almost juxtapose sort of some of these early New York approaches to that with that of where the city was in terms of its growth. I mean, the bridges and the fact that you could essentially, get masses of people sort of to and fro, say on the trolley, relatively quickly, and into and out of a ballpark, and incandescent lights, which you bring up, right?
Yes. The whole.
I mean, so many things that are just so fundamental to New York's growth, right? Arguably,
right.
Perhaps as the modern city of early America, right? Those kinds of things perhaps drove the entertainment value, or maybe presaged it more so than any other region of the country when it came to
that. Oh, very much so. And particularly with these bridges. And you had the Brooklyn Bridge, the first suspension bridge of anything, any size like that ever built. You have that finished in 1883, connecting Brooklyn and Manhattan. But, you have three more bridges across the East River built in the first 15 years of the 20th century. So, yeah, you have all these bridges, that technology. You have, the safety elevator, which makes apartment houses of great heights possible. So you can really stuff people into the city, and you can move them back and forth once you have subways and electric commuter trains. And, electricity just really transforms the city. It makes it a bright, inviting place at night, as opposed to kind of sinister and, oil lit, kind of dark. It makes it a fun place. Although baseball didn't really take the advantage it should have of it. You really could have had night baseball in major leagues starting in the 1920s or even earlier. And they didn't really get around to it until 1938. But, this was something that made it possible, as you say, to bring huge amounts of people to ballparks and back in a very quick time, bring them to the suburbs, bring them to other parts of Manhattan or Brooklyn. This made all, transformed all of mass entertainment, and baseball as the major sport far and away in the country was the main beneficiary of this.
I think everybody knows, the Dodgers and the Yankees and the last vestiges of the New York Giants before they moved to San Francisco.
Yeah.
For the uninitiated, what are there any sort of earlier versions either of those clubs or specific teams that came and went that were maybe essential that most people kind of don't sort of recognize were, key parts of the growth of the game even before those three franchises came to dominate?
Right. There were earlier, the New York actually got off to a terrible start. You have the National Association, which is formed in 1871. And from what I could find, it's the first sporting league anywhere ever, which is kind of amazing. And you have the New York Mutuals, this kind of corrupt team, unsurprisingly, since they're run by Boss Tweed. And then you have a couple Brooklyn clubs, the Atlantics and the Eckfords, but they don't do very well. And from like 1877 to 83, there's no team from New York represented in the major leagues. Then come the team that, the Dodgers, originally the Brooklyn Grays, the New York Metropolitan, who become the New York Giants, and then the Yankees and all that. But the whole time as well, there is, of course, what's going on throughout baseball. There are these African-American teams. And of course, that's the terrible part of baseball history, how long people of color were excluded from the majors. So you have one of the all-time great black teams early on. You have the in about 1914 to 1917, playing in complete obscurity at these little ballparks up in Harlem called the Lincoln Stars. And they were actually funded by the McMahons, you know, the ancestors of the wrestling, professional wrestling guy, McMahons. But that team, it has Pop Lloyd, Oscar Charleston, Spotswood Poles, Cyclone Joe Williams, Cannonball Dick Redding, the great catcher Louis Santop. This is really, I mean, it would have been really interesting to see these guys against the best white teams of the time, because this has some of the great stars of the early Negro leagues. And then you have Alex Pompez, what this wonderful character, El Cubano, who brings in his Cuban stars, where he gets again a lot of great players of color, particularly Cuban and Caribbean stars, and has and this team becomes actually the first black team to become first and only black team to become a minor league team, in this case for the Giants. So, you know, this sort of baseball is also going on hugely unrecognized by white fans around the city. But you know, there are some amazing players here. Martin de Higo, who was on the Cuban Stars, you know, the only person who could really rival Babe Ruth, perhaps, for a title of the greatest player ever. This is, you know, this is what the city is all about, you know. And then there are a couple other obscure teams, you know, with the Federal League, another major league that tried to get into the majors. You had the Brooklyn Tip Tops,
One of
named
the all-time
after.
great names. I think that was because what, of a bread company or something, or
Yes, the owner Robert Ward produced Tip Top Bread, and so he started the Tip Tops. And the sports writers hated this. They refused to call them. They called them the Brook Feds. And then you had, you know, but they really the Federal League knew it had to get the New York market, so they convinced this guy Harry Sinclair, who would soon become very famous for being hu a huge instigator in the Teapot Dome scandal. He was this corrupt oil man, and he moved the Indianapolis team into Newark, where they became the Newark Peppers. And they played out in Newark, but actually in Harrison Park, right next to Newark, and you know, were a team there. But you know, that all the league failed, and it you know, they all went down. You also had an amazing bit in 1890, the strike year. And the strike was something else. This was when ball players growing more and more nettled by the fact that the major league owners were trying to restrict their movement, starting the reserve clause, starting these complete, which should have been completely illegal devices to keep you from moving to another team, even when your contract had expired. So the players formed their first union under this guy, John Montgomery Ward, who was this amazing, you know, lawyer,
Yeah,
and
pl
is
player
sort
by
of,
day, lawyer, law student by night. Yeah,
oh,
that's right.
incredible. You know, and he had married a leading Broadway actress, had another one as a mistress. You know, you wonder where he found the time, but he organizes the players into this union, and they go on strike and form their own league, the Players League. And it gives the two then extant major leagues a real fight for their, a real run for their money. The National League and what was called the American Association, not to be confused with the later minor league, were the two majors. And they had this huge knockdown, dragout fight. At the time, there are five major league teams in New York City. It's all-time record. You have a team, you know, the Brooklyn Wonders, who are the Players League team. There are two New York Giant teams. There's also the Brooklyn Dodgers or Bridegrooms, and there's a team called the Brooklyn Gladiators. Wonderful name, but a terrible team. Actually lost one game when they ran out of baseballs and had to forfeit. You know, they were being hit into the Gowanus Canal, and I guess nobody wanted to go after them. Yeah, so you had this huge fight this way, and it included this epic pitching duel between Amos Roussey, the Hoosier Thunderbolt, and Kid Nichols, up in the polo grounds, and the field right next to the polo grounds that the Players League built, Brotherhood Park. And you know, they people got wind of this game happening in the National League Park, and they kind of drifted over from the Players League Park to watch this. Kind of an amazing moment. These two games being played just about cheek by jowl in the city. So,
Yeah, I mean, and
yeah.
you're again, this is
Yeah.
another microcosm, right? Because all these leagues, right? I mean, you're talking about
Yeah.
five teams across spread. I
Yeah.
mean, New York is a is an epicenter for this, and there's no challenger league, whether it's players or federal or whatever, even the Negro leagues, too, for that matter. They
Yeah.
can't and it will not be taken seriously without at least one franchise in the New York metropolitan area, and it's almost like a cheat sheet about how these leagues came and went and what their dynamics were, which ones were selling beer and which ones were prevented from doing so, and that
No,
kind of stuff, right?
very much so. You know, the American Association kind of made its bones by people called it the Beer and Whiskey League. They allowed the sale of beer and liquor in the ballpark, and also they generally went managed to get around the blue laws. Were in cities where you could get around the blue laws, and they played baseball on Sunday, which gave them a big advantage. You know, this was, you know, and you had, you know, it was pretty wide open. You had things that at one point you had what was called a German disturber at third base, which was a literal barrel of beer. And you could go and if you got to third base, the third base coach would allow you to have a ladle full of beer, you know. So, you know, and there are a disturbing number of episodes going on with fans getting, so liquored up and so upset at the umpires that they attack them with hails of bottles, and you know, the umpires having to fight for their lives to get off the park, to get off the field. So, you know, it was a very rough and wide open sort of sporting life at the time. The American League comes when it started, tries to get into New York, and the Ben Johnson, who's the very kind of fussy, dramatic president of the league, tendency to cry at the drop of a hat, but he wants to get back to these scholastic contests and, you know, fair play and make it a place for ladies to come. You know, ball teams all had ladies' day. They would encourage women to come, so he wants to make it a respectable sport again, and he brings tries to bring in the New York Highlanders or Yankees. But he's kept from doing so by the political machine, by Tammany Hall, till he really kind of pays them off by letting some Tammany guys own the team. And this was par for the course, you
Yeah,
know.
what could go wrong?
What could go wrong? They brought in Big Bill Devery, the most corrupt police commissioner in New York City history, which is saying something, and Frank Farrell, the leading gambler in the country, you know. And this is, you know, and this is the thing: if you didn't play ball with Tammany Hall, they would do something like run a street through your ballpark, which is what happened to the first polo grounds, which is what happened to the Yankees' first park, Hilltop Park, up in the Washington Heights. And you know, this is what you had to go along with for a long time. You know, the guy who really kind of broke part of the hold on that was another Tammany guy, Colonel Rupert, Jacob Rupert, who used beer, your father's medium too, to kind of, you know, break away from this and you know, set the Yankees up as this independent entity that was that really didn't need Tammany any longer to survive.
All right, what's this? Newspapers.com. Fantastic. Hey, today's podcast is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the grand slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers. capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide, dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with this special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. Thank you, newspapers.com, for your sponsorship of this week's episode. And now, back to our conversation. All right, a couple of things. I'm just curious about from your process and stuff. So we've heard from numerous other researchers and authors and historians or however they present themselves on these things that when one does research, especially around early baseball teams, and I got to think New York is no exception and maybe a bigger version of this, confusion in terms of what the actual names of some of these teams were, right? Because the appropriation and what sports writers may or may not been called, and whether they were official names or not.
Yeah.
Examples and how do you weed your way through that so that you don't lose your mind?
It's, you know, nicknames were very much less official in those days. So you would, you know, would go back and forth. It depended what, you know, people called them. You know, the Dodgers at one point were run for many years and managed by this beloved manager, and it became the general manager, Wilbert Robinson. So they would, the sports writers started dubbing them the Robins after him. And then they, you know, to fit into a headline, then they made them the Flock. So to the time they moved out of Brooklyn after the 1957 season, they would still be referred to as the Flock in headlines. They were also called the Bridegrooms because a bunch of the players got married during the off season. The name Dodgers came from Trolley Dodgers, which was kind of a general insult Manhattanites used for Brooklyn people. You Trolley Dodgers, you know, like some kind of put down. Odd, because there were plenty of trolleys in New York, in Manhattan too. So who knows? But that was a kind of a put down for these outer borough rubes. Yankees were the Highlanders, in part because they, one of their owners, one of their Tammany guys, was named Gordon. So that was Scottish. Also, they were on the Washington Heights. They started calling the Yankees apparently because they played north of the Giants at the time. So they were to the north. They were the Yankees. You know, makes little sense. But, you know, whatever was basically fitting names into a headline was a huge motivation. So, you know, this was how they did it. And, you know, it was very colorful. It led to, you know, a lot of... you know, it came up very organically. There weren't any, you know, publicity company, you know, PR companies brought in to decide the team should be named the Guardians after a traffic statue or anything like that, you know, as they did in Cleveland. And it was, you know, it led to some pretty good results.
What I also love about this book is that you take a really good swing, no pun, on some of the, shall we say, larger than life personalities, right? I think that's, you can't tell the story about the history of the city and or the game, and certainly simultaneously without some of the sort of higher wattage. Obviously, Babe Ruth makes a dramatic appearance, almost, I would almost call him a tentpole in your narrative here, but maybe why you thought Babe Ruth is sort of so elemental to this evolution. Some of that's obvious, maybe some of it's not, because he didn't always play here in New York. But then also maybe some of the other names that, you know, maybe, and no, you can't use Foxy Ned Hanlon. No relation.
I love the team nicknames at the time too, but like in the 19th century, there were not one, but two players on, the Brooklyn, I think it was the Excelsiors, who were called, or the Brooklyn Atlantics, who were named Death to Flying Things. They were very good. Bob Death Defying Things Ferguson, because he was an infielder, very good at grabbing line drives. The Lively Turtle was another nickname of the time. Really, really excellent. Ruth was just a transformational character. I'm sure the most famous athletes worldwide are probably either Muhammad Ali or Michael Jordan, but if not, or Pele, somebody, one of the soccer greats. But Ruth was somebody who really made professional sports, professional team sports, big time, like they had never been made before. And in part, he had the perfect setting for it, New York, then the world's largest city and its richest. The world's richest country in America. But also, he was just this sort of fabulous character, ate these gargantuan meals, drove around crashing his cars, pursued any woman he could. Really just a larger than life character. And also, really still unprecedented. The case. People make the case for Shohei Ohtani, who is certainly a great, great athlete. But Ruth was really the best left-handed pitcher in the game, and beat the best right-handed pitcher, Walter Johnson, constantly. Then he transfers from that and becomes a power hitter in a way that that actually transforms the game. And it's hard to think of anyone who ever has matched that. Be if you were the, I don't know, the best point guard in basketball, and you became a center, and you were such a good shooter, they had to change the height of the basket. It was really unmatched what he did, and he's unmatched as a character. We see mostly pictures of him when he's older and fatter, and the Yankees wouldn't let him work out in the off season. It was in his contract, because they were afraid his legs would go, and instead they kind of they got a little petrified. But he was an amazing athlete. Christy Mathewson, who is a terrific tragic story. This he's the first real kind of national superstar in sports, besides somebody who wasn't a boxer. This fantastic pitcher, this kind of goody-goody from a with a college education, but who comes in and makes himself just beloved by his much rougher teammates, and ends up with his wife rooming with a manager, John McGraw, and his wife. I think Frank DeFord said, like, has there ever been another case of this in sports history, where the star of the team and the manager were lived together for X number of years. And terrific pitcher, tragedies on the field, near with heartbreaking losses, but mostly then leaving his the team he was managing because of the corruption on it. And going off and going to World War I, where he is gassed and gets tuberculosis and dies at a very young age. So that's an amazing story. You have Hal Chase, this completely corrupt ball player, great star, but completely
That
corrupt.
really narrows it down, but
Oh,
go ahead.
yeah. He is terribly corrupt. Known for throwing games, although people can never quite nail him for some reason, but he really colludes with Arnold Rothstein in throwing the 1919 World Series, which the throwing of which, the planning of which, also takes place in New York, in Manhattan. So these are terrific stories. John McGraw was a great, one of the very few great ball players to also become a great manager. And managed in two different eras, and came from a tragic upbringing himself. Much of his family died of diphtheria, and his father was unable to deal with him, and kind of he had to go live with this widow across the street. Just grew up, selling newspapers on trains, and you know, played in between the played baseball in between when the trains turned around. But you know, makes it to New York, becomes this another kind of larger than life figure. There's just, you know, you can't make these stories up. There's so much, you know, so many great stories in New York baseball.
No, and that's why I asked that question earlier about it. Just had to be a temptation on some level to maybe be entranced a little bit by a fictionalized approach to some of these characters, or maybe that's even a next project because of these, and we've seen movies, not all of them very well made, right? So like you know some of the Lou Gehrig story and the Babe Ruth things, and you know there's so many there's some rich stories there that truly you could not make them up, and they're kind of frankly impossible to believe given today's modern quote unquote sensibilities. But then again, there's a lot of roguishness and a lot of early, right? That is, there were no rules, there were no boundaries, and it was, you know.
Well, the first novel I wrote, Sometimes You See It Coming, was based in good part on the life, and partly on the life of Ty Cobb, whose mother mistook his father for a prowler and shot him with the family shotgun one evening, you know, which I think accounts for a lot of Ty's particular psychology. But you know, it's yeah. I mean, these stories are kind of, you know, larger than fiction. They're kind of difficult to believe. I mean, Garrig is an amazing story. You know, somebody who grew up, he would swim the Hudson back and forth, you know, as a kid to kind of build himself up. Tremendous athlete, always in the shadow of Ruth. This quiet guy, somewhat mysterious, you know, quite bright, you know, went to Columbia, would go to these, you know, go to opera and weep and such, but at the same time, didn't really seem to know what to do with himself for much of his adult life off a ball field. He would go, you know, he would come back from the stadium and get up a game with the local kids, or he'd go to an amusement park and like ride Playland and ride on the roller coaster over and over. You know, he may have lost his virginity to the baseball Annie he married, you know, and then is struck down by this horrible disease, by ALS. And it's this makes the most famous speech in the history of the game, when they give him this day. You know, it's you just you can't make it up, you know, and it's you know, it's an incredible epic, the this time and the games and the way they were played. You know, I think it's something for everyone, I hope.
In the as we sort of round the corner here, it's very interesting, and I almost wonder if you did this on purpose, right? Is you cul-de-sac this book at the feet of the end of the war, so the middle of the 1940s, which is interesting from a baseball history perspective. I wouldn't call it convenient, because I think clearly the 50s and beyond became a more, there's been plenty of ink spilled on, you know, the whole Dodgers and Giants, you know, ripping the hearts out of New Yorkers and two-thirds of the baseball teams leaving and all that kind of stuff. But I guess that the question in there is that by that sort of period of time, so you know, obviously in the Depression era, 30s, and then the early 40s with the war and stuff, it's by that point, you aside from some Negro League teams, right? You have the three major franchises there, and I think it's really intriguing there because I got to think if you're outside the New York area, you hated to see these various Subway Series. If you were a New Yorker, though, you had to love every bit of it. But it also spoke to, frankly, how relatively few teams there were versus where we are today in terms of franchises, right? New York just had so much history, and by having three franchises, they were three, you know, tenths or 3/14 of the teams in all of baseball, right? So it just by the numbers just, you know, would have to it wouldn't be a shock that at least one New York team would certainly be around come pennant and World Series time.
Oh yeah. For 50 years, you had 16 teams in the major leagues playing in 11 cities, sometimes sharing ballparks. But the New York teams were much more successful than both. You know, by way of comparison, there was one subway series in Chicago, 1906. There was one subway series in St. Louis during the war, 1944. There was never a subway series in Boston. They almost made it in 48. So, you know, New York was, you know, whereas you had, let's see, you had something like from 1949 through 58, every team that, well, except for 1949 through 56, every world champion was from New York. And this was, you know, this was very dominant. Yeah, everybody must have hated it. However, it became, you know, a thing that people loved to a certain degree. Sports writers loved going in to New York to cover the World Series. You know, you'd go in, be a game every day. In the evening, you went to see the best theater in America. You know, you went to the best nightclubs. It was, you know, New York was really the big town. And this was very attractive to people, even if they were passing through, ball teams, you know, the sports writers, everybody. And we get into that more. I carefully planned it in the sense that I wrote the entire thing so damn long that my publishers, who were very forbearing, you know, at Knopf, said, let's cut this in two and make it two books. But 45 is a good place to end the first one, in the sense that this is the end of the war, and the pressure to allow everyone into the game, to allow Black and Hispanic players into the game, becomes too much for Major League Baseball to resist. Branch Rickey is already in Brooklyn. He's going to bring in Black players to the Dodgers. Tom Dewey, very good civil rights governor, Republican governor, very good on civil rights, has you know, pushed through the first law, first state law in New York State, banning discrimination in the workplace. So this is going to make it inevitable that we have players of color, and they are and they're most likely going to be in New York. And that's where everything changes. So we leave it there. But I hope people are enthralled enough that they'll buy the second book.
All right.
Too.
So breaking news here. Did we bury the lead that there will be a part two to this? Yeah.
Yes, there is a part two. It is written. It needs to be edited and edited severely. But that'll be out in the spring of 2026.
All right. I'm ecstatic about that. All right. So let me ask you one last question, and I'll let you do some promotion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm really curious, though, as you went back in time in the earliest days of this, how much did you think you knew about sort of the game in New York and its history entwined? Mm-hmm. And were there any surprises that kind of you came across that maybe maybe thought it maybe altered your thinking, maybe of the city or the game or that kind of stuff, or did it all kind of sort of fall in line with what you historically had known both histories to be?
I knew a lot of it because particularly for this novel, Paradise Alley, I did a lot of research on New York at the time when the game was first taking off. So, but nonetheless, the characters and just how all this came about, was pretty amazing. And digging up some of these individuals, you know, just what the role, for instance, that was played by Doc Adams, the guy who really should be, if anybody's going to be considered the father of baseball, he really should be, was quite interesting. The shortstop for the Knickerbockers, who was also their secretary and put down the New York rules. Fascinating guy. Ebner Doubleday, pretty interesting, though he had nothing to do with baseball. He was best friends for 20 years with the guy who was president of the National League and never mentioned baseball. So, you know, all of that sort of stuff was tremendous fun and very interesting. I knew a great deal about the city already. It is interesting to see how the game fits into the city and how much the game was shaped by the city, and to a certain degree, vice versa. You know, how New York is still probably, I would say, the most baseball enthralled city in the in the country. This might just be because most of our other teams are so bad, but I think still New Yorkers are bigger baseball fans than almost any place else, maybe with the exception of Boston or St. Louis. But this is still the New York game.
Well, and I think it's just the heritage and the history and the generational passing along, if you will. I mean, I took my father to who's now 86. He had never been to the quote unquote new Yankee Stadium, but grew up obviously being a huge fan and all that kind of stuff. And we went to Memorial, the Memorial Park out there in the in and we did have some of those sort of Yankee memories, right? That are just generational and are passed along. I mean, not so much Mets, obviously, but even the Mets are an amalgam or a mongrel, if you will, of, and even their logo and their color scheme, at least revert
Oh,
back to
yeah.
the old Giants and the old Dodgers. So there's probably a, and I'm sure people in St. Louis and people in Chicago and Boston will probably yell at their devices at this point, but I think it's hard to argue just how deep and long and unbreakable, sort of, and maybe uniquely so, it has the roots of the game and this city go hand in hand with each other.
Oh, very much so. And, and we forget the Mets now are going to be, this is, I think, their 63rd season coming up here. So that's a lot of time to develop an allegiance, to a lot of time to be frustrated and heartbroken. Same thing for the Yankees. And yeah, I feel, my father was an old Giants fan of the Giants team. And the Giants were really the Irish team, which my father was about half of, for many years. And that was, he really lost a lot of his feeling for the game once they moved away. We moved to Massachusetts and he started rooting for the Red Sox, which frustrated me. But some of the best times we had together, probably the best times, were going to the ballpark together, going to Fenway Park, which I have to admit is a beautiful, wonderful old park. And, we'd go there, go see the Yankees play the Sox. And that was, that was a good time for us, when what was not always a happy relationship, that was when I think we were most at peace with each other. And I think, countless fathers and sons and mothers and daughters as well, what everybody can say the same. And that's the great thing about the game.
All right, our thanks to Kevin. The book is a must read, highly encouraged, and run, not walk, to go get yourself a copy. It's called The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. And it is by our guest this week, Kevin Baker. It is published by Knopf. There, I said it correctly this time. And you can get it wherever good books are found, whether that's your independent bookseller down the street or on our website. Go to goodseatsstillavailable.com. Just search up this episode number 340, and you will find a convenient link or two to the audiobook version, the Kindle version, or the hardcover. It is out now. And you can also look at Kevin's other works, a prodigious body of work, at kevinbaker.info. And there you will notice that Kevin has a great assortment of books, many well-reviewed over the years, in both baseball, for example. Sometimes You See It Coming, the sort of Ty Cobb loosely based novelization, if you will, that came out a bunch of years ago, as well as New York City topics embodied in, for example, the City of Fire historical fiction trilogy, that being Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row, all of those excellent books if you're into old-timey New York and a little bit of a dream sequence of what perhaps some of the stories that might have been going on around that time in the earliest days of the city growing up into what it has now become. Again, it's kevinbaker.info. And you can also follow Kevin on Twitter/X at Baker Author. At Baker Author. I'll let you figure out how to spell that. You should be intelligent enough to know that. And we appreciate his blended affection for both New York and baseball. And as you heard him say, news breaking, that there will be a version two of this story to come in the years ahead, the sort of 1940s-ish and beyond to modern day encapsulation of the New York plus baseball story. We look forward to that, of course. And if we're still around doing this, we already have an early inside ringside seat for our second conversation with Kevin. All right. If you're curious about our other episodes, by all means, go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. We post all of our episodes there, of course, all 340 now. You can stream them. You can download them. You can share them with friends. Hey, you can even go on the website and donate. Buy us a cup of coffee if you'd like. The little button there, the little Ko-Fi button. Give us a couple of shekels directly, just as a little tip jar, if you will. If you enjoy, that's a new feature. But of course, you will enjoy hopefully all the other episodes. The best way, of course, though, is to ensure that you get every episode by subscribing or following us wherever you get podcasts, available wherever you can find them. And if you can't find them wherever you download or when you stream them, let us know, please, so that we can make sure that we can update our RSS feeds accordingly. Let's see. You can send us email at hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. And you can follow us on socials as well. We're on the Twitter/X thing at Good Seats Still. You'll find us on Threads at Good Seats Still Available. You'll find us on Instagram at Good Seats Still Available. And you will also find a page dedicated to us on Facebook as well. All right. Our thanks, of course, to the wonderful knob twiddling skills of Jerry Payne, Jerry Payne Audio Excellence. And thank you, listeners, extraordinarily out there, wherever you are, many different countries around the world, if you can believe it. We love your support. We appreciate your support. And even if you don't tip us on the website, we appreciate you listening for sure. We'll see you next week. And until then, please take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.